Hello, welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Every week I read from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. And boy, do I have a couple great articles this week. I've got to get started right away. So let's kick off with the must list. And then we have their top story, which is lengthy. And then a really good article about Black Mirror. So, let's start with the must list. The Last of Us, Season 2, A24's Warfare, and The Handmaid's Tale, Season 6, top this week's must list. A Cuban Party on Broadway and John Hickey's family drama novel round out our picks for the weekend. This is by the Entertainment Weekly staff. It's not the first, or second, third, or fourth time the Fantastic Four have attempted big screen success, but it is the first time they're entering the Marvel Cinematic Universe. For our latest cover story, stars Evan Moss Bachrach, Vanessa Kirby, Joseph Quinn, also featured in a must list entry below, and Pedro Pascal, ditto, welcomed Entertainment Weekly to set in London to preview their upcoming The Fantastic Four First Steps. Seems like the fifth time might be the charm. That was Patrick Gomez, editor-in-chief. So the top of our list is The Last of Us. It's not always the mushrooms that kill you, it's the emotional devastation. This HBO hit returns with a vengeance, in more ways than one. It's been 5 years since Joel, also known as Zombie Zaddy, Pedro Pascal, decided he'd rather save Ellie, played by Bella Ramsey, from an operating table than allow doctors to develop a vaccine against the monster spawning virus that destroyed the world. Consequences to that decision show up very early in the 7-episode second season, which doesn't relent until you're left clutching your knees in the fetal position, but in a good way. Warfare, starring Will Poulter, Joseph Quinn, Charles Melton, and more as Navy SEALs, A24's latest is unlike any war movie you've seen. Told in real time and in one location, the harrowing film plays out with palpable intensity and striking detail. The Handmaid's Tale. The final season of Hulu's dystopian drama based on Margaret Atwood's novel and starring Emmy winner Elizabeth Moss promises to take the fight into Gilead's heartland. Will June and company finally triumph over fanatics who destroyed America? Please? Buena Vista Social Club. A party. That's the best way to describe this new Broadway musical adaptation of the 1999 documentary on legendary Cuban musicians. The story spans across two eras, but it's the infectious song and dance numbers that have crowds literally dancing in the aisles. And we have Big Chief. Succession-level family drama gets an indigenous twist in John Hickey's new thriller. Outsider Mitch Caddo runs the Passage Rouge Nation government alongside tribal president Mac Beck. Their re-election bid slides into violence and chaos when an activist and Mac's estranged sister enter the fray. That is our must list for this week, The Last of Us Season 2, A24's Warfare, and The Handmaid's Tale Season 6 top this week's list, and it was by the Entertainment Weekly staff. And we just heard that Entertainment Weekly was on set with the Fantastic Four crew. That's what the cover article is. Welcome to the retro future, inside the Fantastic Four's first steps into the MCU. The Fantastic Four First Steps stars Pedro Pascal, Vanessa Kirby, Joseph Quinn, and Evan Moss Bachrach, and director Matt Shakman reveal how this movie is different from what you've seen before. This is by Christian Haloub. Reed Richards' lab is a wonder. The home base for the smartest man in the universe has been built out in real life for the new Fantastic Four movie and divided into three sections, organized by the primary colors. The Red Room is for research, with tables full of inventions. The Yellow Room is for thinking, and is thus filled with blackboards covered in complex equations. And the Blue Room is for monitoring, complete with sophisticated screens and communication equipment. With a setup like this, it's hard to imagine a problem that can't be overcome. Solve everything was once Reed's motto in the pages of Marvel Comics, and the character has done his best to fulfill that lofty ambition. And yet, something's gone horribly wrong. "Cut the power! Cut the power!" screams Pedro Pascal, in character as Reed, aka Mr. Fantastic, the leader of the Fantastic Four. In response to his desperate order, a blinding light fills the set at Pinewood Studios outside London before cutting out and leaving Pascal's Reed and his family drenched in darkness. "People calling! People calling!" says Ibn Mas Bakrak, sitting at one of the lab's monitors as Reed's best friend, Ben Grimm, aka The Thing. Indeed, lights are blinking all over, indicating that whatever's causing the power outage is also inspiring distress calls from all over the world. For once, the Fantastic Four are at a loss. "We're working on a pretty crucial moment, which in script writing you call the all is lost moment," director Matt Shakman tells Entertainment Weekly on set in September 2024, during a brief break from filming. "The plan that you think is going to work fails, and you have to come up with another plan. The pressure on our heroes is at its highest. But if anyone can figure their way out of such a dark hour, surely it's the Fantastic Four." Reed is brilliant beyond imagination, and Ben is a physical behemoth who will be rendered when the film is finished as a big orange rock man. Even in this hour of crisis, they are joined by Joseph Quinn as Johnny Storm, aka Human Torch, and Vanessa Kirby as his sister, Sue Storm, aka Invisible Woman. Together, they are Marvel's first family, the group that kicked off the modern age of superheroes. Now, these classic characters are headed back to the big screen to see if they can inspire the same kind of wonder they did when they debuted in the 60s, and in the process, save not just their fictional world, but also the struggling Marvel Cinematic Universe. To do that, they have to make the future feel new again, and that means looking backward. Where Kirby meets Kubrick. Reed, Ben, Johnny, and Sue made their first appearance in the Fantastic Four number one by writer Stan Lee and artist Jack Kirby. When that fateful issue first hit newsstands on August 8, 1961, there was no such thing as Marvel Comics. Lee and Kirby worked for the magazine management company whose publisher, Martin Goodman, wanted to compete with rival DC Comics' new Justice League of America series that had become a bestseller by uniting icons including Superman and Batman. So, Lee and Kirby made their own superhero team, but with all new characters who didn't fit the conventions of the genre. Gifted with strange powers by a blast of cosmic radiation they experienced on a pioneering spaceship expedition, years before the moon landing, the Fantastic Four were a family instead of a pantheon. They had no secret identities and weren't always happy. Ben's permanent transformation into the rock-like thing was a constant source of guilt and shame, while Johnny's ability to fly and engulf himself in flames only enhanced his youthful moodiness. Reed, the stretchable man and sometimes see-through Sue, also bickered like a real married couple. The quartet's relatable humanity was combined with space-age optimism, embodied by Jack Kirby's magnificent sci-fi visuals for inventions like the Flying Fantasticar, and discoveries like the extra-dimensional Negative Zone. The blast of colorful heroics against a murky background world immediately set Fantastic Four apart from everything else on the newsstand, comics historian and former Entertainment Weekly editor Sean Howe writes in Marvel Comics' The Untold Story. Fantastic Four was so successful with readers that within a year of its first issue, the tiny comics division at the magazine management company had grown into the bustling Marvel Comics, as other new creations such as Spider-Man and the Hulk joined the pioneering foursome. On top of co-creating those other characters, Lee and Kirby continued to collaborate on Fantastic Four for a decade, publishing just over 100 issues that set the template for Marvel superhero comics as we know them. The team faced supervillains, including Dr. Doom, met fascinating allies Black Panther and the Inhumans, and saved the Earth from a terrifying space god. Even today, those issues are still crackling with creativity and energy. Alas, recapturing that magic on the movie screen has proved elusive. There have already been 3 Fantastic Four movies, 4 if we count B-movie King Roger Corman's unreleased low-budget 1994 Ashcan, and none have set the box office on fire. What united them all was an attempt to crowbar these classic characters into a contemporary setting that was inevitably accompanied by cynicism and condensation. The Fantastic Four First Steps in theaters July 25th takes a different approach by returning to the source, not just Lee and Kirby's stories, but their setting and attitude. So the new film will be set in the 60s, just not our 60s. First Steps is the 37th installment in the MCU, but it won't be set on the same Earth as Iron Man or the Avengers. Instead, the film begins on a parallel world in the Marvel multiverse where history has unfolded differently. In our timeline, the 50s and 60s were full of artists and thinkers who imagined utopian futures full of miracle inventions like flying cars and robot friends. In this world, Reed Richards exists to invent them. Walking through the extensive sets at Pinewood with the film's costume designer, production designer, producers, and director, one word comes up repeatedly: retrofuturism. The aesthetic watchword for this film meant that, in every respect, the creative team wanted to combine 60s period details with sci-fi imagination. To get even more specific, Shackman describes the film's style as where Kirby meets Kubrick, with the original Fantastic Four comics and 2001 A Space Odyssey as the major visual reference points. We knew that we'd be on another Earth, so we had a chance to reinvent what the 60s looked like, Shackman says. I was really interested in imagining the Fantastic Four being astronauts. Instead of Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin going to the moon, what if it was Reed, Sue, Johnny, and Ben who were really the first to go into outer space, the first to push those boundaries? Shackman and his team have done their best to make those lofty ideas feel tactile and real. Just a short walk from the soundstage where the cast was filming that climactic scene is a workshop containing some of Reed's inventions. The robot Herbie, that's an acronym for Humanoid Experimental Robot B-Type Integrated Electronics, is an animatronic android that can zip around on wheels by remote control, and there are 2 different models of the Fantasticar, one with a completely built-out interior for the actors to sit in, and one stripped-down version for the more effects-heavy shots. The Fantastic Car is a perfect example of this film's retro-futurist gestalt of Mad Men-esque period detail and Jetsons-style invention. The lines are beautiful and slick, based on mid-60s American concept cars that were actually referencing European cars, so they have an elegance. Production designer Kasra Farahani tells Entertainment Weekly on a tour of the set. And yet, there are these undeniably 50s-looking retro-future elements, like the turbine intakes at the front and back of the car, and the bubble dome. Even a lot of the interface controls inside are very much based on more of a 50s look. Kirby had a generational imagination, but it was rooted in his upbringing in the Jewish slums of New York's Lower East Side, where he was born Jacob Kurtzberg in 1917. Just a little farther from the Fantastic Car workshop on the Pinewood lot stands a built-out set replicating Ben's native block of Yancey Street, a fictionalized version of Kirby's own childhood neighborhood, complete with kosher groceries and a synagogue. There are no futuristic inventions here, but the retro recreations are just as important to the atmosphere that First Steps is going for. Jack Kirby wrote this character of Ben Grimm as a bit of an homage to his father and to the streets that he grew up on, Moss Bacharach says. I'm a New Yorker, and I've spent a lot of time on Essex Street, on Delancey, on Clinton, so it does feel like home to me, and the production did a beautiful job recreating that. It was so cool to walk down and see the hat cellar and the fish cellar. I was shocked that we were outside of London because it fully felt like the Lower East Side. Grimm, or The Thing, is actually the second character Moss Bacharach has portrayed in the MCU. He previously played Micro, Frank Castle's quote-unquote guy in the chair, in the Punisher series. There are a lot of differences between the criminal hacker and the rock-skinned bruiser, but there's also a particular through line between the two that Moss Bacharach treasures. I think it's cool that Micro is named David Lieberman, who takes his last name from Stan Lee, Moss Bacharach says. Then Ben Grimm is this Kirby amalgamation. So in my brief two portrayals of Marvel characters, I've hit the two big guys. It's a deep honor that I take to heart. All in the Family. Setting and character go hand in hand with the Fantastic Four. As hard as Shackman and his team worked on building the world of First Steps, they knew it would only work if they also nailed the characters at the center. In addition to being the first modern Marvel superheroes, the Fantastic Four are distinguished from their peers by what makes them a team in the first place. While the Avengers are work friends and the X-Men are students and teachers at a boarding school, the Fantastic Four are a family. Everyone involved knew that capturing that dynamic would be the key to success for this adaptation. Casting was the number one challenge for the film, Shackman says. It wasn't just a search for who was the best Ben and who was the best Johnny, but also who was the best family. Who was the best married couple? Who were the best siblings and honorary uncle? So it's been very gratifying to see the incredible chemistry that the four of them have had since the beginning. The stars of First Steps should be familiar faces for fans of prestige TV. Vanessa Kirby made her name on The Crown, while Quinn broke through on season 4 of Stranger Things. Moss Bacharach has won 2 Emmys for his performance on The Bear, though some viewers might still know him best as Desi from Girls. And Pascal achieved an incredible run of starring roles on popular genre shows Game of Thrones, The Mandalorian, and The Last of Us. Marvel isn't the only studio that's noticed their talent, and all four recently moved into blockbuster movies. In fact, Pascal and Quinn were filming last year's Gladiator 2 when the latter was going through the Human Torch casting process. Quinn leaned on his co-star for advice, only for Pascal to soon learn that he too was being sought. By that point, it was starting to feel like destiny. It was a big, strange thing that I hadn't planned on happening. It changed the course of my life in a very sudden way, so I really had to process, Pascal says. I went on a walk with one of my best friends, and while I was talking about it, this charming little girl very aggressively started to sell me lemonade from a lemonade stand. I was so charmed when I heard this voice saying, "What are you doing here?" I look up, and it's Matt Shackman. It's his daughter. Literally, the Sunday after he and I had met to talk about the project, and I had literally just been discussing. This is not what I expected to happen, but I think I have to do it. Then this happened, and as we walked away with our lemonade, my friend says, "I guess you're doing it." For Moss Bacharach, getting cast was easy compared to what it took to bringing the thing to life. I've never collaborated with so many people, literally hundreds of people, between the animators and the designers. It was a real team effort, says the actor. Even though a lot of it is motion capture and created in animation, all of those costume pieces were built. We always had a suit on set that was the actual proportions so we could see how it would all fit. It was an ongoing and never-ending kind of dialogue between me and the designers and the VFX people. It was a unique experience. I felt like the brain. I would make creative choices, and then we'd circle back and they'd make it happen. I was deeply, deeply impressed by the seriousness and the dedication that all the designers had to make this man compelling and human and inhuman at the same time. Moss Bacharach would do multiple takes with different getups. In the scene, Entertainment Weekly observed, he did some in a gray motion capture suit with green dots, and others with different body extensions. In some takes, a stand-in wore a costume built to the thing's proportions. This helped all the actors remember how much space the thing takes up, while also allowing them to relate to the man underneath the rock. The Fantastic Four are very close. They're family before they go out to space and get mutated, Moss Bacharach says. So it was helpful that it was just me standing there, because when Joe or Vanessa or Pedro looked at me, they saw Ben as opposed to the thing. That's really valuable in terms of intimacy and the way that we behave with each other. Human Torch also required a lot of effects to work, though thankfully, Quinn didn't actually have to be set on fire. Much. There is such a thing to too many practical effects, the actor says with a laugh. Johnny is Marvel's archetype of a hothead teenager, but what exactly that means has been open to interpretation over the years. In the 2005 and 2007 Fantastic Four movies, for instance, Chris Evans played the character as a skirt-chasing scallywag. Quinn wanted to do something different. He's a man that leads with a lot of bravado, which can be an affront sometimes. But he's also funny, Quinn says. Myself and Marvel Studios boss Kevin Feige were speaking about previous iterations of him and where we are culturally. He was branded as this womanizing, devil-may-care guy, but is that sexy these days? I don't think so. This version of Johnny is less callous with other people's feelings, and hopefully there's a self-awareness about what's driving that attention-seeking behavior. Johnny is the little brother of the Fantastic Four, Quinn notes, but that's not the only quality that defines him. He is really smart, Shackman says. He's on that spaceship for a reason, and I think sometimes people forget that in various comic stories. He's been one of the most heroic of them, even if he's undercutting his heroism at every turn through humor. He's Sue's brother, which means they're cut from similar cloth. It's just that Sue, and Reed for that matter, are big examples for Johnny to live up to. Cosmic radiation grants Reed the ability to stretch his body in all manner of ways, but his brain is even more impressive. The whole retro-futurist aesthetic of First Steps is made possible by his inventions, and Shackman describes him as a combination of Steve Jobs, Albert Einstein, and Robert Moses. Sue has accomplished just as much in the political realm as head of the Future Foundation, a concept taken from writer Jonathan Hickman's 21st Century Fantastic Four comics, one of the successor stories that is as beloved by fans as Lee and Kirby's originals. She has helped achieve global demilitarization and peace. When Shackman and his collaborators say the dreams of the 60s have been made real in this movie, they don't just mean rocket ships. If he is the most scientifically intelligent person, then she is the most emotionally intelligent person on the planet, Shackman says of Reed and Sue. Between the two of them, they're building an idealistic society. But as cool as it is to see these inventions and imagine global peace, a movie about a perfect society would be boring to watch. So throughout First Steps, a great shadow will fall across this utopia. Remember that all is lost moment? If Reed, Sue, Johnny, and Ben have solved every problem on their Earth, then only something bigger than their planet could scare them that much. The old and the new. Achieving global and political peace sounds only slightly harder than synthesizing the decades-long fictional history of Sue Storm. As Marvel's first female superhero, she's been part of the Fantastic Four since its first issue. But back then, she carried the relatively demeaning codename of Invisible Girl, could only turn herself invisible, and mostly functioned as a damsel in distress. If you played an exact 60s Sue today, everyone would think she was a bit of a doormat, Vanessa Kirby says. So figuring out how to capture the essence of what she represented to each generation, where the gender politics were different, and embody that today was one of the greatest joys of this. Over the years, Sue evolved in several ways. Her abilities expanded from individual invisibility to control over electromagnetic light and force fields, making her arguably the team's most powerful member. At various times, she's become a mother, a leader, and a skimpily clad dominatrix named Malice. Synthesizing all these aspects into a single character was a lot of fun for Kirby, who says motherhood in particular became the key through line. Indeed, Sue's pregnancy will play a significant part in the plot of First Steps. Matt and I were really aware that there really hasn't been a mother with a baby in these superhero archetypes women have been getting, Kirby says. One of the things I love most from Sue's history is when she becomes Malice and all her dark stuff comes out. I was obsessed with that chapter of her life, so I wanted to make sure that there were tones of Malice in there with her, that she wasn't just the stereotype of a goody sweet mother. Kirby continues, I've always been really interested in the mess of femininity, and how can you be both? How can you be all the things? Not just the tough, invincible power woman, but also a mother who gives birth, which is itself a superhero act. I love that these characters are real humans in a messy family who argue and try to work it out and get things wrong. Although Marvel is reluctant to confirm the identity of Sue's First Steps child, the comics canon provides two possibilities, a son named Franklin Richards and a daughter named Valeria Richards. Franklin's mutant abilities are beyond even the most powerful X-Men, while Valeria has an intelligence that could even surpass her father's. As a result, the cosmic beings of the Marvel Universe make a point of keeping tabs on both of them. Franklin, in particular, has long been a subject of fascination for Galactus, the devourer of worlds, who does indeed come calling in First Steps. Reed has figured out space travel and invented robots and flying cars. But how much of that will help when a massive space god comes to eat the Earth? It is definitely a scale of threat which Reed has never experienced, Pascal says. Even the smartest man in the world is awestruck by a being that outdates his understanding of time. Galactus was introduced in a two-part comic story by Lee and Kirby that remains the high point of their collaboration. But when he was brought to the screen in 2007's Fantastic Four, Rise of the Silver Surfer, Galactus was rendered as a faceless space cloud. Galactus will be portrayed by actor Ralph Ineson from Nosferatu, wearing actual purple and blue armor. The costume workshop on set is full of various attempts at making his signature look work. I didn't want us to just use motion capture for Galactus. I wanted to actually have someone there embodying the part, Shackman says. So we've built an entire costume for him. And we've done a lot of photography testing to figure out, how do you make sure the scale is correct? How do you film Mount Rushmore? Positioning Galactus as the antagonist also distinguishes First Steps, since previous Fantastic Four movies all started with Dr. Doom. It's an understandable impulse, since Doom is perhaps the most iconic supervillain of all time. But Marvel's upcoming plans for Robert Downey Jr. as the character freed Shackman to try something else. After Entertainment Weekly conducted interviews for this story, Marvel Studios announced that Pascal, Kirby, Quinn, and Moss Bacharach will all reprise their roles opposite Downey's Doom in 2026's Avengers Doomsday. Doom's a great character, but he takes up a lot of air, the director says. Other film adaptations have done both an origin story and Doom. We're doing neither, and that allows us to look at them from a fresh perspective. If all this works, then the cast and crew will have accomplished something that no one else has before, making the Fantastic Four into a major movie franchise. That might be a tall order for year 18 and movie 37 of the MCU, but crazier things have happened. Shackman made the MCU viable on TV by directing WandaVision, and Pascal has already elevated multiple other franchises. It was really intimidating, Pascal says, about living up to Reed Richards. I relied on the people that I was around to hold me to the experience and help get me through it. Stepping into something like Game of Thrones and then going into the early days of Netflix with Narcos and then Star Wars and the world of video games with The Last of Us, each time I've felt like I couldn't top how intimidating the last one was. They're all scary because you really want to make people happy, especially if it's something that's widely known with particular expectations around it, because you want those expectations to be met. You also want to be authentic to yourself so that it can be the best that it can be for anybody who wants to be entertained by a story and travel with us into this world. Even if they can't solve everything, it's worth a try. That was the cover story. It was a long one. Welcome to the retro future inside the Fantastic Four's First Steps into the MCU. That was by Christian Haloub. And because that was long, I'm a bit late in my mid-episode notice to say that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Entertainment Weekly, and I am reading from their website, which is EW.com. Black Mirror is out, and Season 7 has an episode guide. I don't know if I'll be able to get through all of them, so I may finish this article next week, but this is all about the cast, plot details, and more. we're going to read on for details about each new installment of Netflix's hit anthology. This is by Randall Colburn. He starts with these key points. Black Mirror Season 7 includes 6 standalone episodes. The season's ensemble includes Paul Giamatti, Issa Rae, Rashida Jones, Peter Capaldi, Will Poulter, Emma Corrin, Awkwafina, and many more. 2 episodes tie back to past Black Mirror entries, including a sequel to the Emmy-winning USS Callister. As if you weren't already on edge, a new season of Black Mirror is here to make you distrust your phone that much more. Created by English writer and satirist Charlie Brooker, the Netflix anthology series weaves our anxieties over technology's growing ubiquity with sci-fi and horror elements, as well as a bit of comedy. Its 6 previous seasons have unleashed a number of prescient installments, many of which you can read about in our list of the best Black Mirror episodes. That's linked in this article. Brooker teased Season 7 while speaking with The Guardian. Quite a lot of the technology is being used to relive things or bring them back into the present, he said. It wasn't conscious, but then I have a lot more past than future. He continued, there's probably more social commentary and more emotive or vulnerable episodes. That doesn't mean we don't go back to disturbing places or deliver those chills, but people come to Black Mirror expecting to be surprised, so you can't give them exactly what they want. I'd say there's a little less dystopia. If you want that, there's a 24-hour panel showing it called Your Window. You don't necessarily want to see something saying, things are going to get worse. As anticipation and ennui percolate inside you, you may be curious about the plot, runtime, cast, and commentary of each new story. We've got you covered. Check out Entertainment Weekly's Black Mirror Season 7 Episode Guide. And the first episode is called Common People. Common People was written by Brooker from a story idea by Brooker and Bisha K. Ali. It's directed by Ali Pankew. And what's it about? When a medical emergency puts schoolteacher Amanda's life at risk, her desperate husband Mike connects her with Rivermind, a neuroscience company that will keep her alive, with consequences, of course. How long is it? Common People runs 57 minutes. And who's in it? 3 stars anchor Common People: Rashida Jones, Chris O'Dowd, and Tracy Ellis Ross. Actress, director, and producer Jones is best known for her roles on The Office from 2006 to 2009 and in 2011, and Parks and Recreation 2009 to 2015. She won the Grammy Award for Best Musical Film in 2019 for Quincy, a documentary she directed about her father, the late music legend Quincy Jones. Irish actor O'Dowd led Channel 4's beloved comedy The It Crowd from 2006 to 2010 before finding success in the States in projects like Bridesmaids in 2011 and Girls from 2012 to 2013, not to mention his voice work on shows like Family Guy, The Simpsons, and Big Mouth. Ross, the daughter of singer Diana Ross, led the series Girlfriends before scoring 6 Emmy nominations for work on Black-ish. In 2019, she co-created a Black-ish spin-off, Mixed-ish. What have the cast and crew said about it? It's one of our bleak ones, Brooker told Entertainment Weekly in an interview unpacking the episode's gut-punch ending. No spoilers here. Speaking with BuzzFeed, Brooker said the episode's Rivermind technology could become a reality, explaining that, despite it being quite far-fetched, he believes it is probably happening and about to be launched. Ross spoke vaguely about the episode on a recent episode of Late Night with Seth Meyers. It's a dark episode about a couple that has an accident, a difficult situation, and there's a tech system that they have an opportunity to use that goes a certain way, she says. We're amazing. The writing's amazing, and it's gonna make you ask questions about yourself. Later in the interview, she said her longtime friendship with Jones made filming difficult. She's so good and heart-wrenching in this. It was hard to see my friend going through something, especially when I was kind of the one inflicting the difficulty. Episode 2, Bette Noir. Bette Noir was written by Brooker and directed by Toby Haynes. It's about confectionery whiz kid Maria. She's unsettled when her former schoolmate Verity joins a focus group for one of her creations. There's just something off about Verity, but Maria seems to be the only one to notice. Bette Noir runs 50 minutes, and as far as who's in it, Bette Noir is led by Sienna Kelly and Rosie McGowan, with supporting turns by Michael Workier, Ben Bailey-Smith, Amber Grappi, and Hannah Griffiths. Kelly, who plays Maria, is an English actress known for a UK series like Temple, Adult Material, and Domino Day. McEwen, who stars as Verity, recently appeared in Paramount's Rosemary's Baby prequel, Apartment 7A, as well as the TNT series, The Alienist. She won a British Independent Film Award for her turn in 2022's Blue Jean. So what have the cast and crew said about it? Kelly described Bette Noir as being one of the season's lighter, more fun episodes in a chat with 1883. It's not too existential. I don't think people are going to come away from it shaking about the state of humanity, she said. I have a few friends who don't watch Black Mirror because it's too dark for them. They can't shake it. And I do think that every season has one episode that's just a little more lighthearted and silly, one that laughs at us a bit. Episode 3 is Hotel Reverie. It was written by Brooker and directed by Halu Wang. As far as what it's about, an unusually immersive remake of a vintage British film transports Hollywood star Brandy Friday into another dimension where going off script could leave her stuck in the alternate reality for good. It runs 77 minutes. It stars Issa Rae, Emma Corrin, Awkwafina, and Harriet Walter. Rae was a successful YouTuber and New York Times bestseller before creating and starring in the Emmy-winning HBO series Insecure. In 2023 alone, she appeared in three acclaimed films, Barbie, American Fiction, and Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. Corrin's career is on the rise, having recently appeared as the villain in Marvel's Deadpool and Wolverine, as well as a Hulu series, A Murder at the End of the World, and the box office horror hit Nosferatu. They're perhaps best known for playing Princess Diana on The Crown. Rapper and actress Awkwafina was a YouTube sensation before finding her way into blockbusters like Crazy Rich Asians and Shang-Chi and The Legend of the Ten Rings and Kung Fu Panda 4. She won a Golden Globe for her turn in 2019's The Farewell. English screen and stage legend Walter recently scored Emmy nominations for guest turns on Succession and Ted Lasso, though you may also recognize her from series like Downton Abbey and Silo. So what have the cast and crew said about it? Brooker spoke with The Wrap about how Hotel Reverie was born from two different ideas. One about someone being thrust inside a movie in the vein of James Bond, and another, spookier premise about a digital ghost. sometimes the stories come out in a different form to how I necessarily would have expected going in, Brooker said. I couldn't quite work out how to make either of these work, and then I watched Brief Encounter, this British romance from the 1940s, and something went zoink, and these two ideas glommed together. Along with Corin, Brooker also spoke with the BBC about the episode's exploration of AI technology. I can totally see the value of AI as a tool for creative people, said Brooker. The point at which it worries me is if you remove the people a bit from that equation, or you're just hoovering up their work and regurgitating it, and they're not being paid. Corin concurred. Obviously, I think it's scary, but it's also a massive conversation, right? They said. There are aspects of it that are terrifying to me as an artist. I love the creative process. I love that this art is born out of being in a room with people and things coming from the depths of someone's human experience or imagination. And I really don't think we'll lose that. Or I hope not. Episode 4 is called Plaything. It's a pseudo-sequel to Bandersnatch. It was written by Brooker and directed by David Slade. It's about a tech-savvy social outcast and murder suspect who is linked to an unusual 90s video game populated by cute, evolving artificial life forms. It is 46 minutes long, and the cast includes Will Poulter and Asim Chowdhury, each reprising their roles from Bandersnatch, as well as Peter Capaldi, Lewis Gribben, and James Nelson Joyce. Poulter's career began with early roles of Son of Rambo and The Chronicles of Narnia, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. These days he's best known as Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3's Adam Warlock and his recurring role on FX's The Bear. He was nominated for an Emmy for his turn on Hulu's Dopesick. Chowdhury has a Royal Television Society Award, as well as two British Academy Television Award nominations for his turn in the BBC mockumentary People Just Do Nothing, which he also co-created. He also appeared in Wonder Woman 1984 and Barbie. Scottish actor Capaldi, the 12th Doctor in the Doctor Who universe, won several awards, including a British Academy Television Award for his performance as Malcolm Tucker in the beloved satire The Thick of It. Other notable credits include the first two Paddington films and James Gunn's The Suicide Squad, in which he played the Thinker. So what have the cast and crew said about it? Speaking of Plaything as a follow-up to Bandersnatch, Brooker told The Wrap, it looks like more of a sequel, in a way, than it was necessarily anticipated to be. He was keen on revisiting that world, though, since Poulter's Colin Rittman is one of his favorite characters he's ever written across the seasons. He added, as an anthology show, you don't often get to write for returning characters, so if I get that opportunity, why not take it? Episode 5 is Eulogy. It was written by Brooker and Ella Rode. It was directed by Chris Barrett and Luke Taylor. So what's it about? Following the death of his former lover, a lonely man encounters a new technology that transports people into old photographs for the purpose of crafting a eulogy. Eulogy runs 47 minutes, and who's in it? It's led by Paul Giamatti and Patsy Farron. The Oscar-nominated, Emmy-winning Giamatti broke out with an unforgettable turn as Pig Vomit in Private Parts. Since then, he's emerged as one of Hollywood's most indelible and emotive leading men, with acclaimed turns in films like American Splendor, Sideways, and The Holdovers. In recent years, he led Showtime's Billions. Spanish-British actress Farron is an award-winning stage actress. She's appeared in films such as The Darkest Hour, Firebrand, and this year's Mickey 17. So what have they said about it? Brooker spoke about the episode's inspiration with The Times. One of the new Black Mirror episodes, Eulogy, is about analog photography, he explained. My dad passed away over the new year, and I had to deliver his eulogy. Eerily, life imitated art, and I had to find photographs to project onto the wall. It is striking that, until phones arrive, you had only a handful of photos, and they were all blurry. Now, everything is documented. He continued, I'm writing a lot of characters who are looking back or using technology to excavate the past. I wasn't consciously trying to do that, but I think it's because I'm getting older. I have more time behind me than ahead of me, and maybe it's because the future seems so scary and I don't want to predict it too much. And episode 6, USS Callister, Into Infinity. A sequel to season 4's Emmy-winning USS Callister, USS Callister Into Infinity was written by Brooker, Alley, William Bridges, and Becca Bowling. It was directed by Haynes. Robert Daly is dead, but now the crew of USS Callister, led by Captain Nanette Cole, are fighting for their lives in an infinite gaming realm against millions of hostile players. This episode is 90 minutes long. The sequel to USS Callister features original stars Kristen Milioti, Jimmy Simpson, Billy Magnuson, Milanka Brooks, and Osi Ekele. Milioti was recently nominated for a Golden Globe for her performance as Sophia Falcone on HBO's The Penguin. She's also known for a pivotal role on How I Met Your Mother, as well as the films The Wolf of Wall Street and Palm Springs. An Emmy-nominated actor, Simpson notably played Lyle the Intern on The Late Show with David Letterman and appeared in films like Loser, Zodiac, and Under the Silver Lake. You may also recognize him from Psych, Westworld, or as one of the disgusting McPoyle brothers on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Magnuson is best known for appearing in films like Into the Woods, Game Night, and Aladdin, as well as HBO's Made for Love, opposite his Black Mirror co-star Milioti. He also played real-life figures Cato Kaelin and Robert Redford in The People vs. O.J. Simpson American Crime Story and The Offer, respectively. And what have they said about it? Brooker spoke about the episode's creation with The Hollywood Reporter. The first one ends like you could just carry that story on and follow where they go now. So it was always like, I'm going to do that, he said. It was something that we were looking at for quite a long time. There were various iterations that went through, various versions we wanted to do and were discussing on and off for several years. He added, we continue the story from where we left off, and there are new characters as well. There's new stuff to do with where they've now ended up versus where they were. He offered some more details in a recent interview with The Guardian, speaking about the clones' battle with the Players of Infinity, the game they're now trapped inside. They're in a minute-by-minute scrap for survival, he said of the crew. Everyone else there is a player in the game who will idly blow your head off if they see you, whereas the clones can bleed and die. Executive producer Jessica Rhodes chimed in about the episode's themes and how they pair with the previous episode's exploration of toxic masculinity. We flip the toxicity discussion in this episode, she said. There's a scene where a character who sees themselves as a nice person cannot contemplate another version of themselves. It speaks to nice guy culture with a real understanding of someone's isolation, while also asking, why should your loneliness and anger dictate what happens to my body? So where can I watch Black Mirror? All 7 seasons of Black Mirror are currently streaming on Netflix. That was Black Mirror Season 7 Episode Guide, all about the cast, plot details, and more, and it was by Randall Colburn. A couple of those seasons only have a handful of episodes, and it's nice to have all the seasons available so you can go back to a couple of these and watch the previous version before you have the continuation in this season. I'll tell you, I have watched the first couple, and that first one really does stick with you. Well, that takes us to all the time we have for Entertainment Weekly this week. They were a couple of pretty long articles, but they sure were interesting. Or at least I hope you thought they were interesting too. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you for listening to Entertainment Weekly this week. I've been reading from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. Please come back next week. Last week, I promised the Emmy prediction list or article, and ideally, let's get to that next time. So please come back to hear what Entertainment Weekly is predicting for Emmy nominations, which gives us something to be watching while we're staying inside now that the heat is really starting to turn up. Thanks for listening this week. Until next time, goodbye.